Yeah, I did that.
Okay, very good.
Great, thanks, Tomer. So anyway, thanks again for making time to speak. As I mentioned when I reached out a few weeks ago, you know, really what the reason why we wanted to connect with you, reconnect with you, is because, you know, in April 2020, the Atlanta Opera really quickly responded to COVID, right? And the impact it was having on live entertainment. And so while the vast majority of live entertainment companies were shutting their doors and taking a wait and see approach, you took more of a seize the day approach and moved quickly to transform the Atlantic Opera from a live only company to a digital one. So now 2 years later, you've undergone a lot of changes. Some things have remained the same. And, you know, we'd love to hear more about the outcomes of this digital transformation. So to get a sense of where you were at the start, just before the pandemic, and then where you are today. So for starters, perhaps maybe tell us a little bit about your initial goals for going digital and how those have evolved over the last 2 years.
Cool. So first of all, apologies. I'm driving. So I can't be on video, and I'm probably not going to be as cohesive as I can be because I'm also driving. But I do want to talk about digital as it relates to COVID for a second. We just had a board retreat with our senior managers and our board, and we talked about strategy. And one of the things we talked about is how strategy is a very sterile process normally. You know, you sit in a room, it's air conditioned, you get some good food and everything is perfect. And then you get punched in the face, right? After you make that strategy, stuff happens in the world. And as Mike Tyson said once, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And I think COVID was that punch in the face that we all had. That we all took. And the thing that emerged from this retreat we just had, and you know, this is summer of 2022, is that strategy is good until up to a point. And you have to combine it with emergent strategy. You have to combine it with what happens in the world that is going to turn everything upside down. And then you either freeze or you use this equilibrium for its opportunity. Opportunities. And that's exactly what we've done with COVID. And the three things we've done during COVID was find a tent where we could perform safely because everything else was closed. So we had to invent a location. Number two, we took care of people. We hired 18 singers and paid them benefits and salaries while no other singer was employed. And number three, to your point, we created the digital initiative because our greatest fans did not want to come see our productions live or could not come see our productions live. And we wanted to deliver them to their homes. And so this disequilibrium created an opportunity to create competencies that accompany us now into what is a post-pandemic world, we hope.
So how, you know, when this idea of the emergence strategy, you know, a lot of one of the biggest concerns in organizations is this notion of risk, right? And there was a lot of fear around COVID about, you know, no one really knew what was going to happen. What would be the business outcomes of acting versus not acting? So what, how did you manage risk? You know, how did you, or at least overcome it? Overcome risk or the fear of failure during that initial period when you were.
Yeah, I think the fear should be of not taking risks. That's what the fear should be, because if you're stagnant, you should be afraid of being stagnant because you're gonna be gone.
Okay, great.
That's it. I mean, like, there's not much to add here. It's either that you realize that if you don't innovate, you die, or you don't realize that. And I think a lot of people are just afraid. They're afraid of the fear of just doing something different. And that's not how Micah and I think.
And information is key. You know, we were looking at risks on both sides. There was the risk of our company folding if we did nothing, you know, which is what a lot of opera companies were doing. And You know, the risk of doing nothing would be cutting all of our staff, and keeping people out of work, and having a company that was less successful going into the future, and that was crippled. If we, on the other hand, we had the risk of health, and health and safety with being able to perform. So what we did is we sought out epidemiologists, we sought out experts to help us craft a world in which we could keep performing in the most safe environment possible. While going forward, we said, you know, this is a risk that we're going to have to take in order to keep people employed, in order to keep the company going. But we're going to mitigate as much of that risk as possible with knowledge, and with the experts, and moving forward. So I'd say that knowledge was also key to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so part of it is just, you know, sort of this courage on the one hand to take the leap, and the other one is using information, using arming yourselves with data. Okay, great. And you know, I'm thinking, you know, another question that I have is just this is the question of audience, right? So the digital channels have allowed you to tap into new audiences, right? And you know, this is an assumption I'm making, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it also, you know, some of the audience that digital has opened up is perhaps entirely different from the original audiences that you have. Would that be fair to say?
It's a combination. You know, it was meant to create a channel for our nearest and dearest to see our productions when they were not comfortable coming physically. But what it has done, it allowed us to create a platform that will be accessible by people all over the world that have an interest in opera. And it also allowed us to exponentially increase the number of eyeballs, both when it comes to our brand, but also from an education standpoint. So if our Pirates of Penzance in schools was able to reach 300 schools and cafeterias and gyms, now it can go to another 50,000 kids in areas all around Georgia and maybe Florida, because now it's virtual. So there are impacts that we did not think about when we had that knee-jerk reaction of, let's make sure that our nearest and dearest, that our patrons have a chance to see the operas that they can't attend physically.
And I'll add to that, even beyond the film initiatives that we took on, the digital initiatives, we inadvertently created a new experience for people that became a real catalyst for the company. Not just for the staff being able to work in this outdoor environment with an immersive experience in a tent where we were creating opera, utilizing every safety measure and incorporating it into the costumes, incorporating it into everything. But we created an experience for the patrons that came to see it, a much more intimate, upfront, immersive experience that we didn't realize we could create and that we didn't realize people wanted. And we've taken that going forward and realized that there is a whole new realm of experience that our patrons are seeking and wanting, which has helped us from a branding and bringing in new people to the art form and to our opera. You know, we just completed a show at Pullman Yards here in Atlanta, which is a big outdoor, it's a bunch of old warehouses, and we took one of the warehouses and converted it and had a hugely successful performance of Cabaret with a whole new audience that came to see it. And so it really taught us something about the experience that we can provide.
Mm-hmm. And so how is audience acquisition different for digital versus live productions or live content?
So I just arrived in my office, and if I heard you correctly, you said, how is audience acquisition different between live and digital? I think, let me ask you first, sorry, a good Jewish boy always asks in response to a question. Do you mean paying audience or do you mean audience?
I guess I mean eyeballs, you know, whether they're digital or people in a seat. You know,
okay, because there's a huge difference between somebody who is going to see your product without paying and somebody who's going to pay $200 to see your shows. And when you only have the second option of somebody that will pay $200 to see your shows, you're limited to, if you do, let's say, a production of Madame Butterfly, you're limited to at the most 12,000 people that will see the shows. at the most. You know, if you sell out every seat, which never happens, typically, you know, we sell 60, 70, 80%. So, you know, you would consider it a success if you have 9,000 people watching your shows, okay? Now, if you have a digital initiative and it's picked up by Georgia Public Broadcasting and it's broadcast on a Sunday afternoon, then suddenly 13,000 additional people saw it. And if you put it on your social media for free, then you could have 50,000 people more seeing it. And if you stream it like we did in this past season, you can ensure that 1,000 more people will see it when you stream it on your platform. Now, all this, though, is unpaid audience. And there's a big distinction between unpaid audience and paying audience.
Mm-hmm. But do some of the people who are watching these broadcasts, so some of this unpaid audience, is this also bringing new audiences or growing the audience that is coming to live shows as well?
I don't know. So you have two questions in your question. I don't know if there are new people that come to the shows because they saw the show digitally. That I don't have the data, and I doubt that that happens. But what I do know is that the footprint and the branding and the eyeballs are now not just in Atlanta, but they're worldwide.
Okay, great. All right, so in the last 2 years, so these, you know, you've created a number of initiatives, such as the ones that you mentioned early on, the Big Tent, some of the digital content, et cetera. And which would you say have been some of the most successful initiatives of, you know, throughout this transformation? Or how?
If I mentioned three, right? I mentioned people, location, digital. Two out of the three were slam dunk. Digital and immersive experiences. They're accompanying us into the future. When it comes to having a company players or a band of artists that are fully employed by the company, I'm not sure that that's something we will pursue in the future. Two out of three, not that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. So let's talk a little bit about organizational structure as well. So at the organizational level, you know, what was required to successfully pull off and sustain these new businesses?
You want me to hit that one?
Micah, you want to start? Yeah.
Yeah. I'll say that we, you know, with the help of Change Logic, actually, you know, Vanessa, we had to really revamp our entire thinking about organizational structure in order to be able to present a season within the COVID pandemic environment with only a couple months lead time. You know, when the pandemic hit, it completely eviscerated all of our plans. Just like Tom said, we had a plan until we got punched in the face. We had no plan. And the organizational structure was not serving us. You know, it was a structure based on planning 2-3 years in advance and a certain bunch of systems that were set up for that. But what we needed is a show in 2 months and a way to do it. So with the help of Change Logic, we developed our sprint system where we took staff members from different departments and paired them up, gave them a goal and said, go make it happen. You know, whatever you need to do, put it together. If you need, you know, we want to remove roadblocks and help you make decisions. And the staff put together a show around a tent, you know, bringing an entire venue into a baseball field and putting the show together. And they were moving fast. And I would say breaking things, but they didn't have to. The hurricanes took care of that. But there was a lot of moving fast to get that show on the road. And it took a complete revamping of and understanding of what organizational structure meant. Mm-hmm. I think we learned a lot from that going into the future, where we've started creating hybrids of, you know, as we're going into a system of planning now deeper into the future, we're re-engaging some of the older systems, but where we need certain decisions made quickly, we're using that sprint tool to be able to engage new projects and to make things quicker. You know, last season we started something called the 96-hour opera project, which is something we've never done before. It was a libretto and composer competition to be able to identify underrepresented talent in the field. And we we didn't have a plan on how to, you know, how to put that together. How do you bring in contestants? How do you, what kind of an agreement do they sign when they're, you know, in an application? How do you select the contestants? What are the rubrics for judging the contestants and then having the competition? All of this was brand new to us. So we put together a sprint team and said, make it happen. Let's put this together. And they just started making things happen. And so it's a real excellent tool for innovating something new and getting a team of people to just put something together really quickly. And then you can move it into the phase of these longer planning cycles in a different sort of system. That's what we're working on now. So I'd say in that sense, the innovative structures that we brought to the organizational structure have been lasting and really helped us get through this.
So I also, would you repeat that question? I just want to make sure that I'm totally on.
I was asking what at the organizational level, in terms of organizational structure, what was required to successfully pull off and sustain these new initiatives, this new business?
Got it. Three things. One, vision, clarity of vision. When you don't know where you're heading, anyone can take you there. You know, it's like you have to have a clear vision. And we had a clear vision about we wanted to create a platform and to broadcast to our patrons the shows they couldn't achieve, they couldn't see. The same thing with we wanted to perform live despite the inability to do so. Two, culture. No fear of innovation. No fear. Like the fear should be of not doing anything. And that's a cultural thing because people are afraid, and that's normal, of doing something they haven't done before. I have people here that are experts in marketing, producing, selling, and fundraising for traditional shows. You tell them you need to market, produce, sell, and fundraise for an immersive show outside in a circus tent. You have to market, sell, produce, and fundraise for a film. Are you kidding me? So the answer is like, we can't do that. I don't understand. I don't know. That's not in my wheelhouse. And so the culture has to be, yes, we can. And that leads me to the third point, which is leadership. You have to have stubborn, very stubborn, almost foolish leaders that are listening to perspectives, but also that can stick to their guns when they believe in something. And, you know, Andy Benz just came to Atlanta and was a part of our retreat. And we had a drink afterwards. And he said, you know, the thing that I think was critical for the success of the success that you had during the pandemic is that you are almost stupid in how you refuse to listen to the people that said no. And he said, I remember members of your team calling me and I was playing tennis and they said, Tomer is crazy. We can't do shows in a tent. We should not be doing this. This is nuts. How can we do this? And you insisted on that and people thought you were crazy, but you know what? You don't take risks, you don't get anywhere. And you know, so I'm not saying this to pat ourselves in the back. I'm saying this as, this is a lesson. Sometimes you have to be crazy if you have a vision that you really believe in and stick to it and convince people to do it.
Sounds like both good tips for budding corporate explorers around the world and also, you know, rules to live by, generally speaking. Hey, Tomer, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Well, you know, I really just have one last question, which is related to the more socially just programming that I have seen. So the last few years, I've seen that there's been an increase in the level of socially just programming at the Atlanta Opera, particularly since the murder of George Floyd in the summer of 2020. Can you tell us a little bit about this social transformation, if we can call it that? And maybe even how it relates to everything else that was happening, the other transformations that were happening along at the same time at the Atlanta Opera.
Yeah, you know, so just living in Atlanta is a part of being in the middle of a very aware social justice community. There's a huge history here of social justice. There's a great diversity in the city. I think 50-50 is the ratio. And the Atlanta Opera has made it a priority for itself to make sure that we reflect the city that we're in. And during the pandemic and before the pandemic, our efforts were to program shows that will show the diversity and the richness of this culture. So it's the shows that you're programming and the people that you put on stage. So if, for example, you're doing shows like Maria de Buenos Aires and Frida, about Frida Kahlo, the painter, which are catering to the Hispanic community, and you put Hispanic artists on stage, then you reach a whole community like that. If you're programming Porgy and Bess and Yardbird about Charlie Parker, and you cast it in such a way that is all African-American artists, then you reach out to that community and you have patrons that come to support the artists that they see on stage that reflect themselves. So that happened before the pandemic. During the pandemic, we have made it a goal to cast the people that were in our shows in a very diverse way. So if you look at the 18 people that we hired as company players, almost 50% of them were diverse, African-Americans, Hispanic, Asian, et cetera. And then one of the things that emerged out of the pandemic and post-pandemic was the dearth of focus on training and making sure that the pipeline, that there's an investment in the pipeline, because we all want to see more diverse talent on stage, behind the scenes, in the technical and administrative functions of the company. But there is also a reality, and sometimes there's not enough training going on into ensuring that there's diversity in the pipeline and in the talent. And so our focus was, let's try to help in that regard. And when I was thinking about commissioning operas about diverse subjects, I realized that talking to my team, we only thought about the people that came to our mind were used to belong to one group of dominant race, one dominant group. And there was white male composers. And so we made it a goal for ourselves to identify, nurture, and provide the platform for librettists and composers of diverse backgrounds. And that's why we created the 96-hour project, that is basically a competition to identify that talent. And at the end of it, they receive a cash prize and the opportunity to write a new opera for the Atlanta Opera. That was a long answer to your question.
No, but it's actually really interesting, because we see similar parallels in the tech industry, right? Dominated by a certain profile, you know, generally white men. And there are a lot of programs that are, you know, trying to bring more women, more queer, trans people into tech. And one of the ways of doing that is not just, you know, it's not just opening jobs or hiring people, you know, hiring more diverse populations for these positions, but also working on the pipeline. So it's interesting parallel here, something similar in a completely different industry. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, great. Well, I mean, this was wonderful. Maybe we can just end off with you giving us a quick preview of what we can expect from the Atlanta Opera this fall.
So it's a big blockbuster season. And we are doing four main stage productions that are some of the most famous and beloved masterpieces. Madam Butterfly, with an amazing cast. Candide, again, with a fantastic cast. Don Giovanni and Das Rheingold, the first installment of the Ring Cycle. We're also bringing two shows to our Discovery series. One is Bluebeard's Castle, which will make its Atlanta premiere. It's a fantastic opera by Bartok. And the spin is really interesting. It's about dementia and the decline of elderly people. And through the lens of this fantastic musical piece, Bluebeard's Castle. And then in the spring, we're going back to Morehouse College produce a piece written by an African-American composer, Joel Thompson. It's called The Snowy Day, and it's based on the famous children's book, A Snowy Day. So it's a very exciting season for us.
All right. Well, Tomer, Micah, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. Take care.
Yeah. Bye. So you'll send me this recording, right, Zomer?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
all right.
Working on it. Thanks.
Great. Bye. Nice to see you both. Ciao.
Bye.